Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's healthlock.com.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Donald Trump has been fined for contempt of court. We have such a great show for you. Senator Tammy Duckworth stops by to talk to us about IVF and Democrats trying to protect it. Then we'll be joined by Sarah Bird Sharps, who is the Senior Director of Research for Everytown for Gun Safety, to talk about Tennessee's horrifying new law, which puts more guns in schools. But first, we have the host of the Mary Trump Show, the one, the only Mary Trump. Welcome back, my friend and yours, the only good member of the entire Trump family, Mary Trump.
Well, my kid's pretty awesome. That's
Right. Okay. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
That's a really good point.
That's okay.
Yes. One of the few members.
It's because, you know, she's like a unicorn.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. So let's talk about this trial that is going on, the Trump hush money trial. I mean, it is what's so interesting to me. And we've talked about this before. And like, I think we can pull this back to sort of make it even more of a thing. But, you know, it really is true. Like, this is the first time the guy has ever been held accountable for anything ever. Right.
Yes. Yeah. In any serious, real way, for sure.
And like, as you're watching it, I mean, you are not watching this in real time because, first of all, there are no cameras in the courtroom, but also, like, I am so sick of your uncle. I can only imagine how sick of him you are.
Yeah, I actually wrote about that yesterday. I was like, I am so tired of him. I'm tired of every aspect of being.
Right. I mean, even if he were like a normal political candidate, which he isn't, I mean, he is like a not very smart guy who somehow managed to almost end American democracy multiple times. Right. I mean, he's not a genius. He just sort of hits it right. Right. I mean, isn't that really what it is?
Yeah. And I don't mean this in an ad hominem way. He's grotesque.
Right. No, he's definitely grotesque. But I mean, like the fact that he's managed to capture the zeitgeist and then just bang us over the head again and again.
Right. And that's the point. It's because it isn't just the incessant coverage of him. It's also the people he subjects us to and will subject us to again. You know, imagine Stephen Miller being head of the Department of Homeland Security, or, you know, Jason Miller being attorney general or Steve Bannon being attorney, like the people he surrounds himself with, the way he warps people who might otherwise behave normally, like his attorney.
Yeah, that's such a good point about, I would love you to talk about that, because that is something I think a lot about. And who was I talking? There was someone smart I was talking to about how the one of the things Trump does is he makes these people who are otherwise good lawyers behave in such a way as to ruin themselves.
Yeah, and it's almost to a person. And it's also almost always self-defeating.
Right.
The way, and I, his name escapes me at the moment, Todd Blanche. Jim Trusty, that come from?
Well, Jim Trusty was like the first of these Trumpy lawyers okay. who ruined himself for Trump. Right. Like there are Trumpy lawyers like Rudy who were already ruined. Right.
Yes.
And right. There are like two categories of Trump lawyers. There are the people like Rudy who are just, you know, they were never really lawyers. And then there are the people like Jim Trusty and even the guy who's arguing in front of the Supreme Court, who clearly are smart, but who are also ruining themselves for Trump in different ways.
Yeah. And the question remains, why?
Yes. Why?
As far as I'm aware, Todd Blanche had to leave white shoe firm. And it's not just that he did it, it's the case for which he did it. It is the sleaziest New York tabloidiest piece of slime that he's wading through and transforming himself into a creature that is so unlike him. He needs, because his client is sitting there judging him, to be this tough, aggressive, off-putting guy who has basically lost all credibility with the judge in week two, so that Donald yes. doesn't beat him up afterwards, even if it undermines his defense. It's craziness.
Yes. And it's also like a lot of the stuff that they're saying, right? A lot of these arguments that they're using are arguments that Trump has sort of asked them to use.
You know, from the very embarrassing opening gambit of why he's calling him Mr. President.
Right, exactly. And, you know, if we look back, this case is just getting started, but if we look back at the Trump civil case with E. Jean, we really see that at every point, candidate Trump hurt defendant Trump, right? Like, yeah. Defendant Trump is up there, and he could have just said, you know, I don't have the tens of millions of dollars here. And instead he was like, not only do I have the tens of millions of dollars.
Yes, I have the hundreds of millions in cash.
Right, in cash. But yet my bond is faulty, but that's not, that is obviously because I have so much money.
Yes, it's just so, he has so much money that he can't come up with a bond, and he has to borrow right. the money and pay interest because that's what rich people do. No.
Right. I mean,
so basically is, as you say, this crossroads this tension between the candidate and the defendant, and the defendant will undermine the candidate unless the defendant decides to undermine his case. And that's what he's going to do. You know, Donald isn't, just as in the civil case, he's not going to say he doesn't have the money, because that would be a concession to the fact that he's kind of a loser. And in this trial, even if he wants delays or he, you know, needs a break from it, he's not going to call in sick, because that would make him look weak. Although, as if he doesn't look weak already by complaining about how cold it is in the courtroom. I get a flipping parka.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why, like, you can't have a sweater under the jacket.
Could you imagine him in a sweater, though? Like, think about it.
But it's also, like, the falling asleep. I remember early days in 2019, before, or maybe 2020, when this campaign was started going, that someone said to me, you know, it's a real risk for Trump to say that Biden is old, to, you know, basically Trump's whole thing was that Biden is old, right? He's old and that he has dementia and da, 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 which the mainstream media has run with, right? This is, Trump really was, you know, in 2016, 2017, the first and hopefully last Trump administration, there was a piece about Trump assignment editor, right, that he'd come up with some crazy idea like buying Greenland. Yes. And then we'd see even United States senators write op-eds about what a brilliant idea that was. And that sort of happened with Trump saying that Biden was old and infirmed and doddering. And the mainstream media picked that up and ran numerous stories about how old he was. But what I think is interesting is someone said to me around that time, you know, that this is a dangerous play for Trump because Trump is only 3 years younger than Biden. And so when you see him fall in and out of sleep in the courtroom, and obviously it's hours and hours and hours and you can't drink Diet Coke and whatever, but still there is a sense like this is a person who has spent the last 8 years saying that Biden is Sleepy Joe and here is Trump actually sleeping.
Yeah, his projections will come back to bite him for sure. And it is in this instance, and I think it's also revealing just what a scam it was to go after Biden's age. Because what are your criteria for that? Because Biden speaks more carefully because of his stutter and more softly and because he walks stiffly.
He broke his foot. There's a whole thing about how he broke his foot. And maybe that is worth 3 points in polling. I read that somewhere.
But then you look at the other person who he's acting unhinged and delusional vigorously. So that's better. I don't know. I think that the media, it's time for them to look in the mirror and do a little soul searching here, because as we've learned to our chagrin, and that's like the understatement of the millennium, we don't have a Supreme Court that is interested in protecting democracy. So we really need the fourth estate to step up.
Last week, it was like yet another week of the Supreme Court doing things that were just what we sort of suspected they would do, but, you know, was a confirmation you never wanted.
Yeah. And it was back to back to back of just heartbreak and cruelty and viciousness and intellectual dishonesty and MAGA insanity. So it makes what's happening in New York and what may happen in Georgia all the more important.
Someday
where like we can be aspirational, because we always have to look at this stuff on two levels, unfortunately, because Donald is the presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency. I think that these trials, and you know, we've talked about this trial in particular in New York, even the civil trials, they're taking a toll.
Oh, yeah.
He's trapped there. He doesn't have a choice. You know, he can have his Diet Cokes. And for somebody who drinks 12 a day, like being without one for 4 hours is probably very debilitating.
They're so bad for you. I'm going to have a Coke before I'm going to have a Diet
absolutely.
Coke.
Absolutely. So we need people to see that. We need people to see that he cannot stand being bound by rules that the rest of us have to live by all the time. He can't handle scrutiny. He can't handle honesty. You know, he can't go a day without breaking a gag order again.
Right. Yeah, this is coming out on Wednesday, but on Tuesday, Trump got yet again sanctioned for more gag order violations.
Yeah, and then we have another hearing on Thursday to deal with the latest ones, and it will be interesting to see, given the fact that the judge gave him a financial penalty today and said, unfortunately, I can't assign a penalty that's big enough to make a difference to somebody who is as rich as you claim to be. we're looking at potential jail time, right? So we need to keep that kind of stuff needs to keep happening. But then the Supreme Court, and obviously the most important thing is the Supreme Court is certainly the super majority of these fanatics, these anti-democratic fanatics are hell-bent on destroying American democracy in order to help out Donald Trump. Go wrap your brain around that. But it also...
I cannot wrap my brain around it. It's too stupid.
It's impossible. What that hearing did was give him a much needed boost. And people just keep bailing this guy out. And it's just infuriating. There's not a word strong enough to describe what that feels like anymore.
It's so interesting because it's like one of the things we in those salad days of 2020 when we all thought that there would be accountability
we
for
all
crimes.
Thought we were gonna die.
Right. Well, we also all thought we were going to die of COVID. But I think about this idea, like when you listen to Justice Thomas or Justice Alito, Trump's Michael Cohen on the Supreme Court is Justice Alito, right? And I think like Trump's Rudy is Justice Thomas, right? Those two will do anything for their guy. When you hear them, you know, talking about how there has to be presidential immunity for crimes because, you know, otherwise the presidency, though it's gone on well, you know, for the last 200 plus years now, you know, if you don't have immunity for doing crimes, it's going to be a real problem. I think a lot about like how really affluent white men have gotten away with it pretty much since the country's inception.
Well, I that's why when people say the system, some people say the system is broken and some people respond by saying the system is working exactly as it was designed to. You kind of see they have a point. Because this system was designed by a bunch of rich, landed, generally enslaving white men who wanted to protect their own power at any cost. And because we never challenged that in any sustained way. I mean, we did it in serious ways, but never in any sustained way. I mean, look what happened after Reconstruction. Look where we are vis-a-vis the Civil Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act, I mean, it's all unraveling because one side has been building towards having people like Donald Trump at the head of the party and, you know, wielding real power while the rest of us think, oh, we did that. So let's be complacent now.
Right. I mean, for sure. And it's also, I just think that the guardrails did not hold.
No.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
But it's true and it's very sobering. And I think it is a stark reminder of the dangers of thinking that democracy is a goal. It's not a goal. It's a process. It's organic. It's living. And we need to keep fighting for it. It doesn't just stop. And we think, you know, unless we're a 24th century Starfleet, in which case we've done it.
Then we're in good shape.
Yeah.
It is just completely strange to think of us in this situation now where it still feels really precarious, right? I mean, if Trump wins, you know, I was walking down the street the other day and a woman came over to me who was young and said, Trump can't possibly win, can he? Right? I mean, that's what, and it's what we say to each other all the time, right? Like, Trump can't possibly win, can he? And he could.
Yeah. And it's because so many malign forces are lined up to assist him.
Right. Say more about that.
Well, as we just saw with the Supreme Court, how long have people been saying, well, the rule of law is going to take care of this? Well, maybe not. And do we really think that if by some tragedy he gets back into the White House that they're going to care about state charges? No, they'll figure something out. They'll jail the Justice Merchan or whatever. We've had, obviously, the media, many, many outlets, corporate media outlets have been complicit in either both sides-ism or false equivalency, or the DOJ, you know, in terms of taking so long, because what does that do? That normalizes. We got to a point where people are like, well, how could it be a big deal if it took so long, right? Like, if it were such a big deal, then they would have dealt with it immediately. So that has been an enormous disservice to Americans and certainly to the people who went through January 6th. It's put us in a situation where tens of millions of voters are going to be once again going to the voting booth in November without all of the information.
Mary Trump, thank you for joining.
My pleasure.
When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. Vanta automates compliance for ISO 27001 SOC 2 and more, saving you time and money. Unify your security program management and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, FlowHealth, and Cora use Vanta to build trust and improve security in real time. Access Vanta's free suite of resources to scale your governance, risk, and compliance program at vanta.com/special. That's vanta.com/special.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. When I first heard about it, I thought, it's about time. This makes sense. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in for savings. Let's say you, your spouse, or kids see the doctor or other medical provider when your claims come in, HealthLock automatically renews them and flags any errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. So you pay only what you owe. This is your money you're saving. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped members save more than $130 million. I get it. Medical billing errors can happen, but you should be able to pay with confidence. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden medical bill errors. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's healthlock.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Spring is here, and I bet you are trying to look fashionable. So why not pick up some fashionable, all-new Fast Politics merchandise? We just opened a new store with all new designs just for you. Get t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and tote bags. To grab some, head to fastpolitics.com. Tammy Duckworth is the junior senator from Illinois. Welcome to Fast Politics, Senator Duckworth.
It's good to be on. Thanks for having me.
I'm always a fan of yours. This IVF thing is a topic that I cannot stop thinking, talking about. Where are we right now with IVF protection in the Senate?
Well, I have the best IVF protection bill that I brought up for unanimous consent, which is a way that you can pass legislation here where if nobody objects to it, you pass it, and then it can go to the House to be voted on. And after all my Republican colleagues said that, oh, no, they supported IVF, they stood up and opposed. And in fact, one of the reasons they gave for opposing my IVF bill was that they were afraid that it would allow for the creation of human-animal chimera babies.
Ooh.
Yeah.
These are senators saying this, right?
This is a senator saying this.
Is it Tommy Tuberville, though?
No, it's Cindy Hyde-Smith.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, that tracks.
Yeah, so we're going to get a vote on the floor. So Leader Schumer has agreed that he's going to bring a vote to the floor, and it's going to be the Protect IVF Act. And basically, the bottom line is all we're looking to do is just create a statutory right to access IVF if you want to have IVF. Doesn't force anybody to get it. It just says if you want to get IVF, you can. And it says that doctors and that want to offer IVF services have the right to offer IVF services regardless of the state that they live in, that they practice in, and that health insurance companies have the right to cover IVF services if they want to offer it. So it doesn't actually force anybody to seek it or offer it or provide it. It just says we have a right to do so. And that will be coming up to the floor for a vote. Right now, we're working on FAA reauthorization. And sometime after that, hopefully, at some point before we get too far into the summer, we'll have a vote on protecting IVF. And let's see how many Republicans who say they support IVF actually vote for or against it.
So IVF, all of this IVF banning, legislating, and regulating comes from Republicans' obsession with embryonic personhood, which is now being pushed by the Heritage Foundation. When did you encounter this? Because I sort of know where I was when I encountered this idea that embryos were people. And when you encountered it, were you shocked?
So I started talking about the potential danger for access to IVF back in 2014.
Wow.
Because in 2014, I was going through IVF and I was a congresswoman in the House. And my Republican colleague started talking about a fertilized egg being a person with full personhood rights. At that point in time, my doctor and I had fertilized 5 eggs, and we were looking to get me pregnant for the first time. And he said, hey, of these 5 eggs that we were able to fertilize, 3 are non-viable. If I were to put them in you, they would cause a miscarriage. So the best thing we can do is to discard these. And then just as he was doing that, he said, by the way, if these personhood bills that are popping up all around the country, both at the federal level, but then also at the state level, happens, what we're doing today would be deemed, could potentially be deemed manslaughter or murder, because we are discarding 3 fertilized eggs. They're non-viable, but there's still 3 fertilized eggs. I could be charged as a doctor with manslaughter or murder, and you could be accessory to manslaughter or murder because you're telling me go ahead and discard of those non-viable fertilized eggs. And that was when the light bulb went on for me. And I went, oh my God, this is not just about abortion. This is not just about, you know, 6-week bans and all of this. This is about people like me who are trying to start families. And so where we are today is that when you have a state Supreme Court like the one in Alabama makes a decision that, you know, a fertilized egg is an extra utero child and it's a person, it means that even though they haven't banned IVF, it means that essentially they have, because doctors are not going to provide IVF services in places where a fertilized egg is considered a human being. And by the way, this affects more than just IVF. It also affects birth control devices like IUD that prevents implantation of a fertilized egg.
And the morning after pill too.
On the morning after pill. And by the way, all of this is thanks to Donald Trump. Because of him and Stackey, the Supreme Court, we got to a point where the Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade. And that is what Republicans campaigned for decades. And now we're in a world where states have all these different laws, and many of them have all sorts of laws now in place that essentially makes it impossible to access IVF without putting the person with the uterus or the doctor in legal jeopardy for manslaughter or murder charges.
It is so incredibly insane. I want to talk about Alabama for another minute because this is the first state that did it. We saw immediately that these doctors, you know, you really struck by in this post-Roe America, how much doctors do not want to lose their licenses or go to jail. I mean, you know, they just closed all the IVF clinics in the state until the governor, Governor Kay Ivey, indemnified them from killing embryos, which, again, I feel like that's so important and meaningful, because what she was saying was not embryos aren't people, just, you know, it's okay in this case, right?
Right. But a future governor could change their mind. That was the point. They're just saying, oh, yeah, you're still killing a person when you discard a non-viable fertilized egg, we're just not going to prosecute you. While Alabama was the first state where the Supreme Court said that a fertilized egg is a human being, you should know that Louisiana has already had a law on the books that prohibits the discarding fertilized eggs from IVF procedures. So they already have a law on the books. So if you can't get IVF in Louisiana or had IVF in Louisiana in the past and you have a frozen egg or frozen eggs are not even embryos in some cases. So you have embryos, you have, you know, the different stages, a gamete, and before that, you just have fertilized eggs. You can't discard any of that in Louisiana. So now, is that child abuse because I've kept a fertilized egg on ice for decades?
Right. No, you could theoretically be considered a murderer by letting a frozen embryo be discarded.
Even a non-viable one. And Texas Right for Life, who wrote the Texas bounty laws that lets people sue the Uber driver who drove you to the airport so you could catch a flight to Illinois to get an abortion, the people who wrote that law have on their webpage that, you know, they're neutral. They can get to neutral on IVF only if the woman agrees to have every fertilized egg implanted, including the non-viable ones that would cause miscarriages. This is where we're going in this country.
So you would have to have a non-viable egg implanted if you wanted to have IVF, even though the non-viable egg would then be miscarried and might cause you to miscarry the viable embryos too.
Yes. Or if you knew that you had, in my case, 3 non-viable eggs and you don't want to jeopardize your 1 viable egg, you would be forced to implant 1 non-viable egg at a time and go through 3 miscarriages.
Jesus.
And by the way, that's expensive. Not only health-wise, it is devastating, but it's also every procedure is incredibly expensive and hard on the body with all of the drugs you have to take and inject and all of that.
Yes. It feels like it's set up in a way to make things as unpleasant for women as possible. When you read the Heritage Foundation, I don't know if you've got on their 2025 site, but it's the stuff of nightmare fuels. There's a whole sort of thesis about how, why isn't IVF regulated? These are the people who don't want to regulate anything, but they're like, IVF can cost one thing in one parts and other in other parts. And why isn't there greater regulation for IVF? I mean, it doesn't this seem so nakedly misogynistic? Aren't you sort of shocked by the hypocrisy? You probably aren't, but I'm just curious what your take is.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a hypocrisy, but there's also science denial as part of it.
Right.
And well, my bill that says you have the right to access IVF says that the IVF that is provided must be what is accepted medical practice, not experimental stuff, not, you know, human right. animal chimera eggs. <right? laughs> But that's what they bring up. And so when you see things like Heritage Foundation saying that you need to regulate IVF because it will be the Wild Wild West, that is really science denial of where the science really is today. And frankly, you know, women's most intimate health decisions should not be up for debate in every state, and they should not be decided by extreme right-wing judges and science deniers. And frankly, you know, we're being dragged back to laws that are 160 years old in some states, and we really do need to pass legislation that provides a statutory right for women to have access to IVF. I mean, you know, it is, there is definitely a misogynistic aspect of this where women can't be trusted to make their own health decisions. When you start with IVF, where do you go next? Do I start to have to go and get my husband's permission to take an aspirin? Is that what's next?
That is sort of what's next, right? I listened to 2 really insane Supreme Court decisions this session. You'll remember that after Dobbs, I think it was Justice Roberts who said that now they were done with abortion. 2 years later, they are not done with abortion. You had EMTALA. Can we talk about that? Because so this is this emergency medicine. Basically, the Biden administration is suing Idaho because Idaho has got these women who are, you know, dying of miscarriages and having to be flown out of the state because Idaho won't save their lives. Were you sort of shocked by that decision? Probably not, because you're used to this insanity, but I'm curious what your take is.
I'm not shocked by it, unfortunately. This is what happens, you know, and again, this goes back to what Republicans have been working on for decades, which is to overturn the protections Roe v. Wade. What Donald Trump worked very hard along with Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans to basically steal Supreme Court seats. This is what the Supreme Court justices who lied to members of the Senate, who said that, oh, no, I'm not going to gut Roe v. Wade, and then turn around and did exactly that. This is where you end up. And I live in Illinois. I'm surrounded by states where women are being told by doctors, you need to go sit in your car outside the emergency room and bleed out a little bit more until you get to the point where you're nearer to death before I can work on you.
Yeah.
You know, and look, in my state, we welcome women and we trust in them to make their own reproductive choice. And we welcome doctors who want to move from these other states to Illinois. But this is really bad for women, especially lower income women in these states that are losing these doctors. You're seeing OBGYNs flee, literally fleeing these states like Louisiana and Alabama and Texas.
And Florida now, Tennessee.
And Tennessee. And you're going to see, you know, women in these states not have access to basic health care.
We just talked for a second about this science denialism, which does seem to really be an enormous and important thread in this Republican Party. You know, it's been sort of latent through the Bush years. You know, it's not out of nowhere, but it does strike me that COVID really helped it along. Like, these people did not come out of COVID being like, thank God for vaccines.
No, but it goes back, right? With the science denial, this does go back. But where we are today is really when it comes to women losing their rights to reproductive health care, making their own reproductive health care decision. This begins out of the abortion and the anti-abortion movement. And frankly, if you go back and you look at some of these groups, they've always said that they would go after IVF, but they didn't want to talk about it because first and foremost, they wanted to go after abortion and you know, call themselves pro-life. How can you be pro-life and be against a procedure like IVF that helps people to create life? And, you know, when Alabama, when that state Supreme Court decision happened, you saw interviews with women who, and I, you know, they were asked questions like, well, who did you vote for? You know, I'm pro-life. Of course I voted for that judge, you know? So of course I voted for these legislators and I voted for laws to end abortion. But, and yes, I believe that, you know, fertilized egg is a human being, but why are you preventing me from getting my IVF? They're very disconnected from the science behind it. It's like, well, this is the logical next step from what you're doing.
Abortion has always been a controversial issue, right? There's always been, I mean, it's now more popular than it's ever been because it was taken away. But IVF is wildly popular. There's no one, I mean, former Vice President Mike Pence had IVF, right? So, you know, like they're trying to get people against something they aren't against. Do you think this will work? And also, what do you think the thinking here is?
We're at a play. This is basically an anti-choice monster of Republicans' own making because they were going after abortion and they became more and more extreme. 16-week bans, 12-week bans, 6-week bans. Fertilized egg is a human being. So a complete ban. Complete ban isn't enough. So a fertilized egg has to be a human being. You know, and I've been warning that IVF would be next for years. And this is what Republicans have gotten us to. And frankly, it's a far cry away from the justice and reproductive freedom that all families deserve. But I'm not surprised that we're here. This is just the next logical step. And I don't think people understand, again, it's the science portion. I mean, I had a miscarriage in one of my IVF cycles, and I had to have a DNC in order to be able to clear out my uterus in order to start my next IVF cycle to have my daughter now, who's 6 years old. But I would not have been able to do that if I were living in one of these states that had these total bans. We're where we are because Republican politicians jumped on the anti-abortion bandwagon without fully understanding where it was going to get to, or in some cases, maybe they did, and this was always their goal. But frankly, ultimately, this is because of them, and this is because of Donald Trump, where we find ourselves today.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth.
Thank you for having me on.
Sarah Bird Sharps is the Senior Director of Research for Everytown for Gun Safety.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Sarah.
Thank you, and thanks so much for your interest in this really important issue.
Yeah, I think this is kind of the most important issue. You know, I was about to sort of say that it's hyperbolic, but I actually don't think it is. I actually think it is the most important issue. So we're talking about school shootings and keeping kids safe in school, and you have a plan to keep kids safe in school. Let me guess that it doesn't involve arming the children and teachers.
That would be correct.
So tell me, talk to me about what that entails.
So I'm going to start out by kind of setting the stage by saying that if more guns made us safer, the United States, with more guns per person than any other nation, would be the safest country in the world. And instead, we have a gun death rate that's 13 times higher than our peer high-income countries. So to my view, and based on, you know, a lot of research on this, arming teachers is not the answer.
So let's talk about what the answer is.
Sure. And sort of more generally, we need to focus on intervening before a gun gets into the school, right? Because we've already failed if somebody has brought a gun into a school to do harm. And so the arming of teachers is really way too late to be trying to intervene in this situation.
How do you do that?
So the first thing is to understand sort of who these shooters are so that you can then begin to think about what, you know, would prevent them. And one thing is that most shooters are a current or a former student from that school. And I think that the Department of Justice did a study over a couple of decades, and they found that 9 in 10 school shooters over many, many years were a current or a former student. So when you understand that, you understand that some of the solutions that have been proposed are just completely unrealistic and, in fact, sometimes even dangerous. So, you know, these really expensive metal detectors and all the bulletproof glass and all of these things, and even the drills, only work to the extent that the former or current student knows exactly what the protocol is and what's happening at what time and where. So that's really an important thing to understand. The other thing about knowing that it's a current or former student that really makes arming teachers much more complicated is that you're asking a teacher to convert themselves into some kind of, you know, sharpshooter in the face of somebody who they may have taught or they knew, you know, over many years. It's unrealistic.
Yeah. I mean, I also think like the teachers don't become teachers to kill students.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, all of the sort of the National Education Association, that all of the member organizations of teachers in this country oppose arming teachers. And that's, you know, tens of thousands of teachers in this country. It's not what they signed up for.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. One of the fundamental things that I'm struck by is this idea, if you have a gun in your house, you're significantly more likely to be shot by accident, right? I mean, guns just don't seem to protect in the way that their PR tells us they do.
Absolutely. And, you know, we track unintentional shootings and they're happening every day in this country. People are getting, you know, shot and killed or killing themselves or injuring themselves every day from a gun that was not securely stored, particularly children. There's a, you know, many Americans don't realize that nearly once a day in this country, a child gets their hand on an loaded, unlocked gun and shoots themselves or someone else. So, and, you know, and the message there is it's on adults to have the responsibility to keep the guns locked up securely and securely stored. And that relates to schools too, because 70% of the guns that come into schools with a shooter came from the home of a parent or a close relative. So the solution is not to have more guns on more people in the schools. It's to make sure that the homes are places where guns are not accessible to children.
But one of the things I'm hoping you can talk about is they need to raise the age to buy automatic weapons. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And some states in this country have a minimum age requirement that requires either handguns or long guns or both not to be able to be bought unless you're 18 or older. Many states don't. And those laws are proven to be hugely impactful to prevent people who shouldn't have their hands on guns. People are too young. 22 states have raised the minimum age for purchasing firearms.
And are those blue states?
Many of them are. Yes. Federal law requires a person to be 21 to purchase a handgun, but only 18 to buy a long gun, including an assault weapon.
So insane. The Supreme Court, the very conservative, Trumpy Supreme Court, last year there was a case where they fought with New York State about New York State's stricter gun laws. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think you're talking about Bruin, right?
I'm talking about Bruin, yes.
So, I mean, basically what a number of states, including New York State, want is to be able to make decisions, to have some discretion about whether somebody who wants to buy a gun should be able to buy it. The Supreme Court said, no, you know, if you can fulfill the requirements and you don't have any record of a mental health prohibiting or a felony or a domestic violence restraining order, there's no discretion in there. And they took that away. Many states, the states that are impacted, including New York State, have tried to find other ways to protect us. when sort of one door closes, you know, we're trying to open other doors to figure out what can legally be done, you know, to reduce the, you know, 120 gun deaths a day in this country, every day, day after day.
I talked to Chris Murphy about this topic and I was, you know, a little bit despairing. And he actually said, no, there's real progress being made and it's organizations like yours that are doing it. So can you talk to us about what the sort of reasons to be hopeful here?
Sure. And I am really hopeful and I'm not generally given to be a cup half full kind of person, but I am generally hopeful. One reason I'm hopeful is that young people give me a lot of hope. They are the generation that has grown up with, you know, school shootings and lockdowns and constant drills and all of these things. It's impacting them in a profound way, and they've decided to raise their voices. They're talking to legislators, they're doing research, they're walking out of schools, they're really organizing to be able to change this. And that's one thing that gives me hope. A second thing that gives me hope is that there have been laws passed in the last year, important laws that are, you know, safer, including secure storage laws in a couple of new states that didn't have them before, which are holding gun owners accountable for not locking their guns securely. And those laws are some of the laws that research shows are the most promising, that really protect young people from suicide, kids from getting guns that they bring into schools and cause school shootings and more. And so, you know, to me, those laws immediately, the minute they're signed, can start to save lives.
Do you think that, like, the holding the parents accountable, what happened there in that shooting, do you think that is actually helpful?
It's extremely helpful. It reminds every parent, nobody, including that family, you know, wanted to go through the horror and the trauma, you know, that has turned that family upside down forever, right? As well as the families of the victims, right? Seeing that in the news, I have no doubt that other parents realized, oh, you never know. We need to lock our guns securely. It's an extremely important incentive, a reminder that is a basic responsibility of a gun owner. And responsible gun owners know, take storage seriously and do it. You know, most gun owners store their guns securely. Unfortunately, millions don't. Many households have multiple guns in them, and people think that, you know, they're going to keep one gun out for self-defense. There is a guarantee that any children in that house know exactly where that gun is. It's in some states criminal and in every state highly, highly irresponsible.
What are the kind of things legislators should be doing to help dissuade people from having guns in their house or having them unsecured?
So I would say it's not about having guns in your house. It's about all of the ways that we can make sure that guns are being stored securely, but also that if anybody is in crisis around those guns, that something is being done. So I think one of the laws that's extremely promising and that many states now have and every state needs to have is extreme risk laws. And those laws empower families and law enforcement to act on warning signs if somebody that they love is in crisis, including, for instance, well, anybody, somebody who is having suicidal crisis, somebody who's saying things that worry them in any way. So 21 states have these extreme risk laws. Research is showing that they're incredibly important for having families have something that they can do. And when you talk about school shootings, you know, what's really clear is that kids give off many warning signs. In fact, the Secret Service did a study over a decade, and they found that 100% of school shooters show some sort of concerning behavior in the lead up to it. And 77% of the time, at least one other person knew, right?
And it's probably really more.
Probably more, right. So in that case, the whole chain of events, and there's multiple moments at which somebody could intervene. Unfortunately, too often, it doesn't happen. And I would say this is, for me, another really important point is one of the reasons that it doesn't happen is because kids don't have an adult in the school in too many cases that they feel that they trust, that they feel comfortable confiding in. And why is this? I think one of the reasons is because teachers are carrying guns and schools are becoming like fortresses with, you know, metal detectors and bulletproof this. And it really erodes the trust that kids need. And for me, you know, as a parent, the most frustrating thing after these horrific shootings is when you the media interviews kids and they found that so many of the kids in the school knew that the kid was in crisis, that the kid was being abused or bullied, that the kid had a gun and they were putting photographs of it on social media. But yet no adult was alerted to this. And that for me is one of the most important school-based actions that we can do to reduce school shootings is to create a trusting and nurturing school climate instead of a fortress with the school officials having guns. It's antithetical to what we're trying to do and to the solution.
Is that more money for mental health? I mean, is it more money for schools? Is it money going to different places? I mean, what is the plan?
Yes to all of it. Certainly more money for mental health counselors, better training for mental health counselors, a better ratio of mental health counselors to students, also more training of the whole school, everybody, all the staff in the school to understand warning signs and to think about, you know, how to create a nurturing and a trusting in school climate, school environment. So, yes. And, you know, less money going to very expensive, high-tech solutions that actually are not proven to work. They siphon money off of our underfunded schools in the first place. They create an environment that's intimidating and that does not breed trust. And they're particularly bad for kids of color because in those schools and in those situations, you know, implicit bias, you know, tends to implicate them. So it's even further sort of unhelpful.
When you look at school shootings, they are largely an American phenomenon. They happen in other places, but we have the most. Is that because of the guns, or is it because of the culture, or is it because of both? And there is for sure a lot more pushback than there was, but it's still very much a fact of American life.
It's a fact of American life because of the guns. There's not more mental illness in this country than our sort of other peer countries. The rate of mental illness is pretty much the same. There's not more, you know, pressure or bullying in schools. You know, adolescents bully one another. Like, that's certainly something that happens, you know, in every country. It's, you know, more guns per capita than any other country in the world. We have 350 billion guns in circulation in this country. In fact, only Yemen comes close to the gun arsenal we have in this country. And Yemen has been in a civil war for a decade.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Yemen is not a country in a great place right now. So the idea that Yemen and in the United States are tied is probably not great. If you're listening to this, like, what should Americans be doing on guns? If you're just a sort of casual but exasperated listener, what do you suggest people do?
There's, I think, a lot of things that people can do. Sort of, first of all, gun owners can make sure they're locking their guns, storing their guns securely. So that's locked, unloaded, and separate from the ammunition. Second thing is, parents, when they send their kids over to somebody else's house for a play date, just have the conversation with the parent. Do you have any guns? And if so, are they locked securely? Then you avoid that tragedy that is so preventable of kids getting their hands on a loaded gun. So that's kind of our actions. The second thing is to really engage with your school to make sure that they're doing the things that the facts show really make a difference and not spending resources and money on things that traumatize kids and that harm them and that don't make a shooting incident less deadly. And then the third thing is to support lawmakers who understand that, you know, common sense gun laws are not about taking guns away. They're about keeping us safe and keeping our kids safe in this country. So those are extreme risk laws and secure storage laws, sort of top of mind, and other laws as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung-Fast, this interview in Time magazine is really getting a lot of people scared. What are you seeing here?
Trump did an interview with Time magazine, which is just horrific and includes a lot of really scary plans for 2025 if he is able to get elected, including detention camps, U.S. military at both the border and inland, national abortion bans. He would let red states monitor women's pregnancies and prosecute those who violate abortion bans, he would, at his personal discretion, withhold funds appropriated by Congress, according to top advisors. He'd be willing to fire a U.S. attorney who doesn't carry out his orders to prosecute someone. Basically, it'll be like every bleak dystopia mashed up together. And that guy is polling very well. And that is our moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.